Ooh. It's Thursday, 7 p.m., and time for another edition of All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio with your host, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida.
If you have any questions or anything to talk about, we will be more than happy to talk to you about or search it for you or try to find information for you out there, because there is a lot of information out there about wine.
Call our guest line at any time during the show and talk about wine on air. Dial 646-727-3235. That's area code 646-727-3235.
Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is just trying to educate people and let them know, you know, trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly. You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Holyfield Vineyard and Winery in Basser, Kansas.
Organic Farm on the coast of Maine near Mount Desert Island.
Westport Rivers, Westport, Mass.
HaberHill.com. The Napa Valley of the Midwest.
RainbornWines.com in Santa Rosa. The philosophy for my brand, Rainborn, is to only use dry farm vineyards, hence the name Rainborn.
The best way to reach us here at Ten Spoon in Montana is to go to www.tenspoon.com.
Alba Vineyards.
We're the largest estate vineyard in New Jersey.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery, New Jersey's top-rated winery for 2011.
Andia Vineyards on Route 93, that's the main highway coming right up the center of New Hampshire out of Massachusetts.
Vivac Winery, we are actually the highest-rated red wines in New Mexico.
Call now and talk about wine on air. Dial 646-727-3235. That's 646-727-3235.
Well, Southwest Wine is actually located in Deming, New Mexico.
Well, Lavinia is the oldest winery in New Mexico.
Castello di Borghese, the first winery established in Long Island.
Blackhead Lake Winery, and we're located at Glacier Park in Montana.
Famous Prairie Winery in Moscow, Idaho.
Brotherhood is America's oldest winery since 1839.
Ithaca, New York, College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
The website is freethegrapes.org.
And now, it's the show dedicated to the wine industry.
Come and visit Sheila Lara Vineyards and Winery.
This is Dr. Tom Cottrell. He is with the University of Kentucky Extension in Lexington, Kentucky. He's an enologist there.
I learned winemaking from the then 39 wineries in Napa Valley.
All right. We have Jason with us tonight.
Good evening, Ron. Good evening, Mike, from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Not only am I an attorney that a good part of my practice focuses on wine regulations and litigation, but I also am the president of a vineyard up here. I started the Hershey-Harrisburg Wine Country.
Again, the website is greenbelt.com. Our phone number is 401-847-3777.
Info at hummingbirdridgewinery.com.
My dad always said I'm a jack of all trades. He said that when I was just a little guy.
Anyone out there who is interested in this software, you really need to go check out this site. It's www.uncork.biz.
That's really what we're about, and that's, as you said, uncork.biz is where our main site is, and that's where people can read lots about it.
Info at vineyard@hershey.com.
Well, I grew up on the farm here in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
We have a website, WALTZ Vineyard with an S, don't forget the F.
Paul is a blogger.
It's blog.penlive, P as in Paul, ENNLIVE.com/wine, and that should get you to my wine classroom.
It's wineflower.com, all one word, wineflower.
It's all about wine. Here is your host, Ron.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Buster. Thank you. They have to make noise because it's cold out again.
That was it. My audio is dropping out really bad. I'm going to...
I hear you. I hear pinging and dinging and all that.
Yeah, I think I'm going to... I'll disconnect real quick and then I'll come back into it and see if that helps a little bit. Yeah, it's definitely dropping out a few times.
Yeah, I'm having a problem with mine too here, so we may have a great show tonight. I'll see you. Go out and take care of it. We'll see what we can do here.
Was the intro dropping out on you in the
No,
beginning?
I was. It was good. It was good all the way through. I was just hearing a ping. That's all. Just a little pinging in it.
Okay.
Just like
you're okay. Pulling up a new website or something. Yeah.
No.
No. I keep on getting the following plugin is unresponsive. Skype. So for some reason it's showing that my Skype is unresponsive.
I wonder if Skype is having issues.
Maybe
right,
it's Skype. I don't know.
Yeah. It could be. Well, I will disconnect. I don't have to get a guest on yet until later on in the hour, so I will drop out and then try and get back in and see what happens. Hopefully
okay. I'll go ahead and start talking about our subject tonight then while you're taking care
of
stuff.
Cool. I'll be right back.
All right. Tonight, Israel and Israeli wine. I mentioned last week that we're going to be talking about kosher wines, a little bit about Israel, and we are. We have a guest later on. He's a rabbi, a local rabbi here who has agreed to come on and talk to us about the concept of kosher and how it came about and stuff like that. Interesting conversation. I had a little talk with him today, and it was a very nice conversation. I asked him to be on the program. He said as soon as the kids are in bed asleep so that they won't be awakened, he will join us. So that's going to be about 10 till 8 or something like that. Until that time, though, we have some information to pass on to you, some stuff to talk about Israeli wines and the country of Israel. Let's start out first with Israel, the country of Israel, if this thing will open up. I'm having computer issues myself tonight, so if Mike or I leave you, then it's, I don't know, it might be Skype. It possibility there because we're both having issues, so it could be that.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You're back. Okay.
Yeah. The audio is still dropping out pretty bad.
Yeah, and I'm still getting signs saying that Skype is not working properly, too. So I don't know. It may be Skype. It, you know, maybe connections there.
Yeah.
But we'll plug on through like we always do. And see what happens. Israel, the country of Israel, it is located over in the Middle East. It is bordered on the west by the Mediterranean Sea, on the north by Lebanon, on the northeast by Syria, on the east by Jordan, and on the southeast by Egypt. And then, again, the west is the Mediterranean Sea. It is not a real big country. They have been in existence forever, basically. They are. You hear that beeping there? That's a plug-in unresponsive, saying that Skype is unresponsive.
I'm not getting that. But the audio is dropping out quite a bit.
Wow.
Bad network connection or something.
Yeah, okay. It must be. We will apologize to all listeners out there if we lose you. Then that's why. I think it might be Skype's having issues tonight. But Israel, not a real big country. It's the capital is Jerusalem. Its official language is Hebrew and Arabic. Over 75% Jewish, hence the kosher wine that comes out of Israel. We'll be talking about some of the kosher wines and some of the wineries there in a couple minutes here. I'm not going to go into the history. It really quite a long history in Israel. It's, you know, you go back centuries since before biblical times. You have Israel, and that part of the world has been in existence. People, it's been settled and raided by the Roman Empire. The all sorts of different wars and stuff happened in that part of the world. Basically, what has happened because of all that over the centuries that wine has popped up, grapes have grown. Boy, this thing keeps popping up. It's going to drive me nuts. It has been there for a long, long time. It's divided up into districts. The northern district includes the Golan Heights. It has the Judean Sumerai area. It is the southern district, Jerusalem area, Tel Aviv, the center district, Haifa, I think it's pronounced, and that is it. Most of the areas of that area are the areas. I broke that down for you simply because of the wine-growing regions in those areas. are mostly in the northern part of those areas and northern areas. The wine of Israel, Israeli wine, again, quite a long history, quite a long existence. It's been there since biblical times. In the book of Deuteronomy, in the Bible, they talked about the fruit of the vine and the seven blessed species of fruit found in the land of Israel. And grapes were one of them. It talked about the harvesting and how the Romans, when they were through and around Israel, they took wine from Israel and exported to Rome. And most of the wines that they transported out of Israel at the time, they looked for dated wines, vintage dates. They looked for wines that the winemaker had inscribed on the bottles, actually at the time they were called amphora, A-M-P-H-O-R-A, amphora, which was wine bottles specific for the Jews. In the 7th century, the Islamic conquest of the Middle East virtually wiped out the wine industry. In fact, it stopped it. I mean, it by all practical purposes, because of Islamic laws against alcohols and stuff like that, they ripped out vineyards, closed all the wineries, all the indigenous grapes that were growing in there were disposed of, and that pretty much ended grape growing and winemaking in Israel. That was in the 7th century. It was temporarily revived in the Crusader states around 1100 to 1300. But again, the return of Islamic law after that and Islamic rule pretty much wiped it out again. But in 1848, a rabbi in Jerusalem founded the first documented winery in modern times. It was not in existence very long. And by the mid-50s, it had closed down. But it started up the new revival of wine, if you will, in that part of the world. In 1870, the first Jewish agricultural college was founded and featured a course on viticulture, or the study of grapes. They can say the root of the modern Israeli wine industry can be traced to late 19th century. That is when the French Baron Edmond de Rothschild, and you may recognize the name because he's the owner of the Bordeaux estate Chateau Lafite Rothschild, he began importing French grape varieties and technical know-how into the region, which, if you actually look at a map, that's not an easy import. You know, I mean, you're either going across the Mediterranean or around or something like that. In 1862, he helped establish Carmel Winery. Now, Carmel Winery, and I will talk a little bit more about Carmel Winery in a little bit here. The Carmel Winery now is the biggest winery, and Carmel Winery has also helped other wineries. They have, I want to say sister wineries, but it's a strange setup I discovered while I was researching this. It's a strange setup because Carmel Winery is not just a big winery in itself. Carmel Winery is a like a parent winery or a sister winery for a bunch of other smaller wineries, or I guess a parent winery actually would be a better word, I think. But they have a lot of other smaller wineries there. So Carmel Winery opened up in 1882, and with vineyards and wine production facilities in areas of Rishon LeZion and Zikron Yaakov near Haifa, and these areas are still in operation today. Carmel is also the largest producer of Israeli wine, and has been at the forefront of many of the technological and historical advances in winemaking and Israel winemaking history and the Israeli wine movement. One of the first telephones in Israel was installed at Carmel, and the country's first prime minister worked in Carmel's vineyards as a youth and in the cellar. So it's been around for a long, long time, and it's got quite a reputation. For most of its modern history, though, the Israeli wine industry was based predominantly on the production of kosher wines, and we will go into kosher when Rabbi Jeff comes on, which were exported worldwide to Jewish communities. And they still do almost the majority of the Israeli wine industry is kosher, not all, but the majority of it. And they're expanding it tremendously because of the fact that, well, it is Israel, and they're starting to be recognized as a force in the kosher wine field. But the quality of the wines varied over the years, and they were doing a lot of high-yield production, not so much quality but quantity. And that's really what they prided themselves in. They valued the quantity over in the vineyards as opposed to the quality of the wine. And so they would make a lot of sweet wines. And in the late 60s, that's basically what the production was in Israel, was sweet wines. I should say in Carmel Winery. Carmel Winery then, in the later 60s, started to make a dry table wine, but it wasn't until the 1980s that the industry saw revival is probably the best word, of the industry as a whole. The quality of the wines and the expansion of wineries and popping up in new wines and all that started to happen. That a lot of that had to do with the influx of winemaking talent from Australia, California, France, and also those areas bring in new modern technology and know-how and knowledge about the growing areas and a little bit more detail, if you will, about what was going on. By the 1990s, Israeli estates such as Golden Heights Winery and Domaine de Castel were winning awards at international wine competitions. And then the 1990s also saw a boom in the opening of boutique wineries. By 2000, there were 70 wineries in Israel, and by 2005, that number jumped to over 140. So it exploded during the early part of the 2000 number of wineries here. And it just really got its start in the late 1980s. That's when it started to catch on again. Carmel Winery was the oldest established one, but the others were everything exploded after that. Today, less than 15% of Israeli wine is used for sacramental purposes, and the three biggest producers, which is Carmel Winery, Barkin Wine Cellars, and Golden Heights Winery, account for 80% of the domestic market, which is, you know, when I tell you the numbers here in a little bit, it is amazing how much they make. The United States is the largest export destination, so we get more Israeli wines than anything. I read in another part that you don't notice Israeli wines. There's not sections of Israeli wines. There's not Israeli wines mixed in a lot, because most places throw the Israeli wines in the kosher section of grocery stores and of markets and stuff. And since it is in the kosher section, unless you're actually looking for kosher, you tend to skip it. You tend to ignore it. Based on that, a lot of people don't notice the kosher wines. Even though it contains only around one quarter of the planet acreage as Lebanon, Israel has emerged as a driving force in the Middle East. Lebanon has a tremendous amount of acreage planted. It's a northern neighbor, if you will, but Israel only one third, but it's probably more noted and more advanced in technologies and export market than Lebanon. Lebanon basically sells to local areas. Wines of Israel are really served a lot of upscale restaurants featuring international wines, and it's becoming a force around the world, not just as a kosher wine source, but just as a wine source in itself, winning awards and stuff like that. So the history there is quite diverse. Climate for growing grapes is just about what you would expect. It's dry. They have very little rain. It gets cold, rainy winter seasons from October through March. During the winter, the average rain is around 20 inches. Some areas getting not quite double that. Vineyards in higher elevations can see some snow in the winter, but the growing seasons are basically the same as ours. Basically the same as ours, I say, the United States. It's got a distinct Mediterranean climate, but the country is located about the same latitude as San Diego-Mexico border, right through the Florida here in that area. So we're in the same latitude. The temperature tends to be a little bit milder, except, again, for the higher altitudes. Harvest usually takes place during the evenings or at night when it's a little bit cooler. The vineyards are usually pruned and with a good canopy management to maximize the shade and protect it from the sun, again, because of the dryness there. They obviously, because of the damp weather and humidity, diseases can take its toll on it. But it is still a nice constant breeze in the northern areas there where most of the wine grapes are grown. Southern Israel is basically desert. So when you speak of the growing areas, most all the growing areas consist of the northern regions. The wine is grown throughout the mountain ranges and all that. The border areas are also a lot of growing areas. The majority of Israeli winemaking takes place in the more temperate northern climates of Galilee, Sharon Plain, Samson, Golan Heights, and the Judean foothills in the West Bank. So these are all, again, in the north and north central areas of the country. The size of Israel, just to give you an idea here, is about the size of the state of New Jersey. So it's not a real big country as far as size goes. So picture New Jersey and divide the northern half of it when you're getting on up in, you know, Atlantic City north, and that's about where the growing areas are if you're familiar with New Jersey. The wine regions are really quite large growing areas. The Sharon region, which includes Sharon Plain, located near the Mediterranean coast and just south of Haifa. As of 2012, Israel has, and this is something I had to look up, as of 2012, Israel has 50,000 dunams of vineyards. Okay, 50,000 dunams. Okay, now, acres, hectares, a dunam was a unit of land used in the Ottoman Empire, and it represents the amount of land that can be plowed in a day. Its value varied from 900 to 2,500 square meters. So, like, huh? You know, you can't really, that doesn't really tell you anything. It is now defined as exactly one decar, or 1,000 square meters. So that's a dunam, 1,000 square meters, and it's just it's and it varies a little bit in different countries. I don't know. It seems like they would do a more standard size measurement, but a dunam is 1,000 square meters, more than 80% of all the vineyards are planted in Israel are located in the Shomron, Samson, and Galilee regions. Again, all these are north and northeast. Some vineyards are planted at a higher elevation, up to 4,000 feet. There are seven Israeli wineries in the Golan Heights at a total of with a total of 1,600 acres. There's a bunch of little boutique wineries in the area. They are also subject to all sorts of conflicts and different problems because of political unrest in those areas, which has caused problems with some of the wineries and complaints to different authorities and the people there because of the fact that there has been political unrest and the wineries are trying to get themselves some protection. The Made in Israel on shelves and sells catalogs. Let's see. Here's something where it's okay. The political status of the Golan Heights has resulted in controversy on the export market. Good example, following the domestic demand for kosher wine, a number of Golan Heights wines were marketed as Sisimbolic, Bolaget, Sweden's state-owned monopoly alcohol retailer, as Made in Israel on shelves and in catalogs. Following customer complaints and consultation with Sweden's foreign ministry, Sisimbolaget changed the shelving label to read Made in Israel Occupied Syrian Territories. So, again, political conflict and political problems create problems with the wines also there. This prompted further complaints for some members of the parliament, and so the solution was to remove the designation completely and classify wine as other origins. And so now it just says Israeli wines, and you don't see a lot of these other things popping up on it because of political unrest. Grape varieties in Israel. They do quite well, really, with some of them. During the centuries, the Islamic rule, alcohol production was banned, but the original Israeli vineyards and indigenous grape varieties were all uprooted, but they are now, they've replanted basically again, thanks to Rothschild, in French grape varieties, which were imported in the 19th century, late 19th century. One of the most widely planted varieties, Cabernet Sauvignon, followed by Chardonnay Merlot and Sauvignon Blanc. Recently, they are planting and increasing the popularity of grapes such as the Cabernet Franc, Gewürztraminer, Muscat Canelli, Riesling, and Syrah. Others that are being planted more and more and are starting to get some recognition include the Emerald Riesling, Muscat of Alexandria, and the crossbred grape called the Argamon, which the Argamon is an Israeli wine grape. It is a crossing of a Carignan and Sozua, or Sozao, or however it's pronounced, S-O-U-Z-A with a little umlaut mark O on it. So that is, it's a dark grape, and its origins are, it's a Vitis vinifera, its origins are actually in Israel. So it is a one of the native grapes, and that's the Argamon. The primary problem with Israeli grapes is the acid levels, maintaining a good acid level, and also they have naturally high sugars because of the warmer climate. Vineyards at a higher elevation tend to do a little bit better and produce better wines with a good acid balance. Cabernet Sauvignon has shown to be the best aging, greatest for aging potential so far coming out of Israel of any of the wines, as is Cabernet Sauvignon. It seems to be almost everywhere. Good ripe tannins of the Israel Merlot have increased the wine's popularity on the market. Chardonnay is really starting to catch on too, although Chardonnay is catching on everywhere. The Israeli Chardonnay shows what they say, a highly reflective incident of the terroir, the characteristics of the soil and the climate and all that. And they said the Chardonnay also is the primary grape used in Israel sparkling wine made in the classic champagne method or the method of Champagne. So the grapes, basically the ones we know and the methods we know. As of 2012, the Israeli wine industry produced an average of 36 million bottles of wine annually in a variety of styles ranging from red, white, rosé, still wine, sparkling wines, and dessert wines. There are 35 commercial wineries in Israel. Again, big ones, Carmel, and over 250 boutique wineries. Now, when we say boutique wineries, we're referring to little bitty small ones that, well, like most of them we talk to on this program, they're not big wineries, but enough just to serve a little niche purpose there wherever they are. The 10 largest wineries in Israel in terms of volume are Carmel, and I'll talk about Carmel Winery in just a couple of minutes here, Barkin, Golan Heights, Tepperberg 1870, Binyamini Wine Cellar, Galil Mountain, Tishbeat Winery, Tabor, Reconati, and Dalton Winery. The industry is fairly concentrated, with 75% of the nationwide production coming from the top five producers. So 36 million bottles annually, and 75% of it coming from the top five. So it is pretty well concentrated. The Israeli wines are starting to become recognized around the world, winning awards and all sorts of recognition for what they are doing and how they're doing it and how well they're doing it and what's going on and all that good stuff. So it has become quite a force when it comes to wines, Israeli wines. Kosher wines, which is most of the Israeli wines, I shouldn't say most, a lot of Israeli wines, are made in kosher style. Now, kosher, I'm not going to try to explain kosher to you because less than 20 minutes now, we're going to have a rabbi on here, and he's going to give a little bit of background, a little bit of history and all that on kosher. So we will talk about it then. But before we do that, and let me pull that. You can still hear me, can't you, Mike?
Yes.
Oh, yep. Good. No, okay. I just never know if I just all of a sudden faded out and I'm talking to myself or not.
Oh.
Especially with the issues of the program tonight.
Yeah.
Kosher wine. Is really the country's winemakers weigh on in what they call the quality revolution. This is an article here I read. This is out of the Jewish Week magazine out in New York. A great little bunch of articles, and this is what got me started on having a kosher wine week and talking about Israel and kosher wines because of this article and because of Passover coming up on the 25th of this month. The Israeli wine industry has really exploded, without question. It has become one of the biggest, fastest-growing areas in the world for wine in the last 20 years. I mean, it just they've taken off, and it's taken off to the point where great wines, great areas, great soil. A lot of great winemakers, a lot of people going there and taking their apprenticeship there and learning a lot about it and all that. And those after they went other places go back to Israel and start putting together the wine and getting awards and everything. I was going to talk about, as soon as I find myself a link for it here, I will pull it up, and we will talk about Carmel Winery. There we go. Carmel Winery. It is the largest winery in Israel. And I think I'm going to pull this up because I keep getting Bing numbers here and it's not giving me anything. Why is this? Well, as soon as this comes up here, like I said, I'm having computer issues tonight and these things aren't coming up as fast as I would like them to or when I would like them to. There we go. Carmel Winery. Here we go. A little history about Carmel Winery. Carmel Winery is the historic winery of Israel. It was founded in 1882 by Baron Edmond de Rothschild, owner of Chateau Lafite Rothschild in Bordeaux, which surprised me when I read that. Carmel owns the two largest wineries in Israel, one at Rishon LeZion, south of Tel Aviv, and also at Zichron, I think it's pronounced that way, Zichron Yaakov, south of Haifa. Each has deep underground cellars built by Rothschild in the 19th century. Carmel also has two small state-of-the-art wineries close to the key vineyards to allow production of small quantities of handcrafted wines. These are Kayomi Winery, situated in the Upper Galilee, and Yatir, I believe it's pronounced, winery in the northeastern Negev. The story of Carmel represents the story of Israel, and the recent developments of Carmel's wines symbolize the revolution of Israeli wines in recent years. It says Carmel Winery has 14,000 hectares, or 3,472 acres of vineyards. Oh, my. When I read that number, I'm going, 3,472 acres of vineyards. That is, that's amazing number of vineyards, which cover the land of Israel from the Upper Galilee in the north to the Negev in the south. Carmel's winemakers can therefore choose from vineyards with different terroirs from all the wine regions in Israel. Carmel has a particularly strong vineyard presence in the cooler climate of Upper Galilee, from where many of the leading wines are sourced. Carmel produces 15 million bottles a year, including wines of every style and at every price point. These range from their Carmel Limited Edition, the flagship of the winery, to Selected, Israel's largest selling brand. Selected is their biggest selling wine. Just amazing winery. I mean, this thing is just... We think of Gallo and how big Gallo is and how far it stretches, its tentacles stretch. Carmel Winery in Israel is the Gallo of that region. Their tentacles stretch out all over the place on that also. On their website, and if you are interested, it's simply www.carmelwines.com.il carmelwines.co.il, and that takes you to the website, and you can check more about their wines and the regions and the wineries and everything. It's really quite a great story. It shows all the areas where they're growing. It tells about their wine regions and what they're doing and all that, and a little bit about the climate and everything, but really quite a good website for an enormous, just a very enormously large winery. And then their wines, they have Carmel Fine Wines, single vineyard. They have Appalachian wines. They also have what they call Carmel Ridge Private Collection and Selected Wines. All these are from all their wineries. And they've got different ones at different places and all that. So it's a great website. Again, if you're interested in more information about it, go to, again, www.carmelwines.co.il. And you can check out Carmel's website. Let's see. That one disappeared. There we go. The incident of winemaking and the growth of wine started probably in 1983, like I mentioned earlier, and it has been expanding ever since then. The revolution of the boutique winery started in the 1990s, and that has been expanding ever since then. The making of kosher wines within the country has always been a basis of a lot of the wines. Since they started up for years, the product of kosher wines, the business of making kosher wines was basically kept in the country of Israel. And the reason of that is, like the statistic I gave you earlier, the 75%, over 75% of the country of Israel is is Jewish. And so since the country is mostly Jewish, the kosher wines were kept there. Most of the kosher wines sold around the world have been from the United States and from France and some out of Australia. Israel now is trying to get into that market, trying to become a big part of that market, and they are expanding. They are doing that. They're selling a lot of their wines in the price range of $10 to $15, and because of the price point is good and it's still decent kosher wines in that price point, and they've been able to expand the market around the world and particularly in the United States. There are some nice Israeli wines that are taking a lot more of a foothold in the United States that are kosher. Again, though, the problem arises that they're still being placed on the racks for kosher products, and not in the areas for wines and for wine purchase so much as a kosher product. And because of that, they are not being recognized. And not being bought just as a wine, just because it says kosher. And it's not going to change the taste. It's not going to do anything to it because it's kosher. We'll get into kosher very shortly here with Rabbi. But being a kosher wine does not mean that you should shy away from it or be one that you shouldn't be looking to even try. I'm trying to find here. My computer's working so slow tonight. I apologize for the delays on some of this stuff. But let's see. American wines. Yeah, let's try that. Kosher are Israeli kosher wines. Some wineries have not been doing kosher wines because of the fact that it's they don't want to go through the hassle, or they don't want to go through the expense or whatever reason, and they're realizing that it is almost a necessity. A lot of the smaller wineries that if they want to sell places and stuff realize that they're going to have to go kosher. They're going to have to start doing kosher wines, and they're going to have to start selling to not just to the small restaurants and stuff, but making the kosher wines going to expand their market, and that's what they really need to do. We got a few minutes here before we get our guest on. So I'm going to read you some an article that I'm getting this out of Passover or the Jewish Week magazine. This is what this is. And it lists some top white wines that they say is the top white wines for a kosher wine guide, which is strange because they're saying it's a kosher wine guide and not all these are kosher. I'm not going to read you the whole list, but they got wine not just from Israel, but from around the world. They're talking about lots of different ones. But as you get on the list of just the Israeli ones, you've got different wineries, late harvest Gewurztraminers on this list, the Sauvignon Blanc, Chardonnays, Pinot Grigios, White Rieslings, which is strange that they would call it White Rieslings, but now I guess that's their name. Chardonnays, they've got, here's some wines from California and New York, or not New York, Washington rather, but a lot of different varieties of wines, a lot of different wines from a lot of different areas. Actually, these are wines that have been judged and scored, so it's not just their choice. These are actually scored and judged wines that they show. If you want to check out these lists, if you want to look at these lists, go to the JewishWeek.com, www.thejewishweek.com, and it has a list. Look for the I'll back up here in a second. The March 2013 issue, and the March 2013 issue online list. Actually, these articles I've been quoting you from, plus the list of all these different wines, where they also are kosher or not kosher. So any of our Jewish listeners out there, it will give you the list for your Passover wines. And it also gives you a whole bunch of other stuff on the articles here and everything else. But the wine section, very interesting, very good. So it's this computer, I'm going to go nuts tonight. Seems like it's going slower and slower. So again, the New York Jewish Week, it will tell you all this information, all that. Kosher wines. I didn't know what kosher actually consisted of. We talked to a guest at a winery. I don't know. Mike and I tried to find it when we were off the air last week, and we looked around, and neither one of us could remember what or who it was and what they had to say. But we talked to a guest who mentioned something about kosher wines, and we tried to remember what it was about and what it was, what the criteria was, and neither one of us could remember. And so we threw up our hands and gave up. That's why I went and checked it out this week, and I got a hold of a rabbi, and he set me down and started to talk to me today, and I was fascinated. I was fascinated by it. I asked him about kosher wines and how is a wine kosher? Why is a wine kosher? Why does a wine need to be kosher? And he proceeded to explain to me history of kosher. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It was so fascinating. It was so interesting. And he went on to explain to me about the history of the kosher wines. He went on to explain to me why a wine has to be kosher. He talked to me about a whole bunch of stuff that I knew there was no way I was going to remember everything. And because there was no way I was going to remember everything, I asked him if maybe he would like to join me on the program this evening. And he said, sure, that would be great. He would love to do that. But he said, since the program started at 7 o'clock, he wouldn't be able to come on because he puts his kids to bed at 7 o'clock. And he wants to be sure they're asleep. He says, because once they go to sleep, you can start a chainsaw next to them, and they're not going to wake up. But before then, it is impossible to get them to sleep. So I said, great. We'll get you on any time that's convenient for you. So he suggested 8 o'clock, and I said, okay. I said, how about a few minutes till 8, because you're so interesting. I really want to have a chance to get you on and explain all this stuff. So he says, okay. So I said, I can talk about Israeli wines before, and then we'll get you on the program, and you can tell us why things are kosher and what is kosher and what makes it kosher. And maybe he can continue on telling me all the stuff he was explaining today and explain to you. And he's sitting there waiting for me to bring him on, so I will do just that. Hello, Rabbi Jeff. Thank you for taking the time to join us tonight.
Yes, thank you very much. Good to be here, Ron.
Yes, it's good to have you on the program. So I was just telling everybody, and you might have heard me a little bit there while you were in the green room, but there, I ask you today, what makes kosher? Why is it kosher? Why does it have to be kosher? What causes kosher? And you proceeded to tell me a little bit of history leading up to it and all that stuff, and I was spellbound. I was fascinated, and I also was not able to remember everything. So thank you for joining us the program. Please tell your story over again so that our listeners can hear it.
Okay, and I'll start off saying I'm not an expert on all the kosher laws, but there's a difference between modern kosher laws, I would call them rabbinic kosher laws, and the biblical kosher laws. And this will, in a roundabout way, eventually get to how it affects wine and kosher wine. The biblical kosher laws have to do with what God told Moses in the Bible regarding the animals that were permissible for eating and which animals are not. For example, of the mammals, there's only two criteria that an animal has to meet in order to be fit for food, according to the biblical standard or biblical kosher. And that is that it has to have a cloven hoof, and it has to have, and then it has to chew the cud. So some examples of that, the camel, it'll chew the cud, it'll regurgitate its food and re-chew it and re-swallow it into another stomach, but it doesn't have a cloven hoof. It has a hoof like a horse, a full hoof. But a cow has a cloven hoof. You see a cow footprint in the sand, you know, it's got the cleft in it, and it chews the cud, so it meets both criteria. On the other hand, something like a pig, while it does have a cloven hoof, it doesn't chew its cud. So those are the only two criteria for mammals. For fish, there's also two criteria, that it has fins and that it has scales. And then for birds, it's basically the criteria is that it's not one of the carrion type of birds eating other birds and eating other mammals, but basically your chickens, your turkeys that are eating seeds. And so that's the criteria. And so those are the only things that are described as being kosher or not kosher or clean or unclean, as most English translations describe it. So then that brought up your question, well, then how does wine come into that? How does grapes or applesauce or grape jam or peanut butter or anything else get a kosher certification and label if it's not a mammal, a fish, or a bird? And that then gets into the rabbinic kosher aspect. Again, we just discussed the biblical kosher definitions. But over the years, the rabbis have added to what the Bible says, and that's based on an interpretation of a text in the Bible that says, don't boil a kid, a calf, a baby cow, in its mother's milk. And that's exactly what it says. And so the rabbis have interpreted that to mean not to eat dairy products and meat products at the same time. Again, the text just says, don't boil the kid in its mother's milk. Doesn't say anything about boiling some other cow's kid in its mother's milk, but just that kid in its mother's milk. So, and there could be many reasons for that, and I don't know. There might be things in health-wise that we don't know yet, chemicals or things in a mother's milk that if you're boiling that same kid in its own mother's milk, it might, you know, I don't know. Or it might just be that kind of is adding, you know, to the insult, you know, again, you're taking the calf, you're killing the calf, you're going to eat the calf and then to boil it in its own mother's milk. But whatever the case, that's what God said, and that's all it says. And I believe that's what it means, that God, for whatever reason, thinks that we're better off not eating a calf that we boiled in its mother's milk. But again, the rabbis have interpreted that. Some rabbis, not all Jews, go by the rabbinic interpretation with that. But that don't eat milk and dairy at the same meal. And that gets into your modern kosher laws. But again, still, well, what does that have to do with grape juice? What does that have to do with wine? What does it have to do with peanut butter? Well, it's taken to the point where not only to not eat it in the rabbinical laws, not only to eat dairy and meat products together, but they can't even ever be together. There'd be different restaurants. There'd be a restaurant that only serves dairy products with grains or other things, like a pizza shop, but it won't have meat on the pizzas. And then you'll have another restaurant that would have meat, whatever, meat products sold in it, but they won't sell them in the same if they're going to be kosher, rabbinically kosher restaurants. And so then the same with the packaging of foods. To meet the rabbinic kosher certification, the foods could not even be packaged or canned or bottled in a factory that is also packaging, canning dairy and meat products. So if a factory is bottling or canning, macaroni and cheese with meatballs in it or something like that, or some type of product, then if it tries to bottle wine in that same plant or peanut butter or anything else, it would not receive the rabbinic certifications. That's those little circles on the cans that we see, a U with a circle around it, or some certification companies have a K in a circle around it, depending on which certification company it is. So if a wine, or again any other product, is bottled in one of those plants, it won't receive that certification.
So most wineries are not going to be bottling, are not going to be making pizzas. They're not going to be making, they're not going to be packaging ribs. They're not going to be cooking any of this stuff in there. Most wineries are just wineries within themselves. So wouldn't that qualify almost every winery to be kosher?
Then they would have to get that label on it, they would have to hire one of these organizations, one of these certifying organizations to come and certify that nothing else is being done in there, when they're doing the bottling and when they're doing the harvesting, and meet their certifications.
I see. So some wineries use fish bladders, and are not bladders, but fish oil, if you will, to clarify, to use as an agent to clean out wines and stuff. So that would stop them from being kosher.
Especially if it's a fish that doesn't meet the fins and scale qualification. And again, I'm not an expert on all the, there's a whole line of study in knowing what it takes to certify a plant or a packaging plant or a winery or whatever. But again, biblically, going back to the biblical doesn't even mention grapes or grape juice or grape wine being in the, or any fruits or any vegetables being in the classification of whether clean or unclean or kosher or not kosher. And so for Jews or other people who are not looking for the rabbinic certification, but just looking, let's say, even just to follow what the Bible says, anything that is a fruit or vegetable, or again, not a mammal that doesn't have a cloven hoof or doesn't chew the cud, or a fish that doesn't have fins and scales, the type of birds I mentioned, would be fine.
You mentioned something about rice and different, the purity of something.
Okay, on the
while we were talking today.
Right, with the Passover itself.
Right.
You had mentioned that you went into the store, you saw an aisle that had, matzah that's kosher for Passover, as opposed to matzah that's sold all year long. And so there is a certification for that, too. It's basically the same matzah. Passover matzah is cooked quicker, has to meet a certain how many minutes it can be in the stove and this type of thing. And all, again, that's all rabbinic laws. It's not in the Bible on how long to cook the matzah. So that certification for making it kosher for Passover specifically has to do with those extra rabbinical laws. the on the ceremony of the Passover, the Passover goes back to the symbolism of coming out of Egypt, and all the different parts of it have to do with Egypt. For example, the wine represents and reminds us of the blood on that first Passover when we were there in Egypt during the 10 plagues. We came to the 10th plague, and God told us that there was going to be this 10th plague, and the firstborn child of every home was going to die unless they put blood of a lamb over the doorpost. Now, that would have been for Jews or Egyptians, anyone who believed that, anybody who heeded what God said after seeing the first 9 plagues, and which didn't kill anybody, unless they went out in a hailstorm. if they put the blood of a lamb over the doorpost, the angel of death would pass over, and none of their children would die. And so everyone who did that took a lamb and put the blood over the doorpost, the angel of death passed over. And so that we drink the grape juice, or the juice, the wine, as a remembrance of that, that symbolism there.
Uh-huh.
And we actually drink 4 cups in the Passover. Now, in modern-day Passover Seders, we'll drink from the cup 4 times, each one having a little bit different meaning, but all having to do with coming out of Egypt and that deliverance that God did. And the matzah, because we didn't have time to let the dough rise, and so we it's unleavened, and we eat it that way. Now, many Christians at this time of year are celebrating Easter, which often falls around the same time. And the reason it falls around the same time is because they are celebrating it. Really, the roots of it is the same event. The Last Supper, very famous painting, right? The Last Supper painting. Let's see, who was that? Michelangelo that painted that, or
I believe so. Yes,
painted that famous painting, and that's a Passover meal. That's a Passover Seder. That is Jesus' last meal was a Passover, and he also is mentioned in the historical gospel accounts. It mentions 2 different times of drinking of wine. And one time he says the traditional Jewish blessing, the same blessing we say today, same blessing obviously we've been saying for thousands of years. And he held up, one time he said, I will no longer drink of the fruit of the vine with you again until I eat it with you in the kingdom of heaven. Another time he picks it up again later on in the dinner, and he says to his disciples, this is my body. This is my blood, rather. And so, again, the very similar symbolism of the Passover lamb, the blood over the doorpost, and there Jesus is in that same glass and glass of wine, and making the same type of analogy that it represents his blood as representing the Lamb of God. So the angel of death passes over our lives because of his death. And so the symbolism is very similar, and again, because they're both based on the Passover.
Uh-huh. The you mentioned today, too, that there originally one word that described fermented grapes and fresh grapes, and it was a matter of context to understand if it was meant to mean fresh or fermented, and matter of context was lost in interpretation. What was that word you were...
Yeah, the Hebrew word is yayin, for translated in every English Bible I've ever seen, as wine. But as we look, like you're saying, context, sometimes it's obviously referring to fermented wine, because sometimes it talks about people being drunk. In Proverbs it mentions having bleary eyes, and the wine moving in the cup, going through the fermenting process. And so it's obviously referring to the fermented alcoholic wine. But in other passages, it talks about the fresh fruit of the vine, as is said in the prayer, same thing in the prayer that Jesus said and the mention that Jesus said, fruit of the vine, so obviously fresh. Another place it talks about the fresh, the blood of the grape. And so it has this fresh connotation to it, the fresh squeezed connotation to it. And so we can see in context there that it's talking about grape juice. But there is no two words in Hebrew, one for grape juice, unfermented grape juice, and fermented grape juice, or alcoholic wine. So there's only one word. And for whatever reason, the translators didn't take the time to look at the context and use our two different English terms, grape juice for one and wine for the other. And so today, just about all, or certainly most Passover Seders around the world, they will drink alcoholic wine during the Seder for those four cups. But the symbolism, if it's representing the blood of a spotless lamb, in the Exodus, we couldn't just choose any lamb. It had to be our best lamb, without blemish, without a, you know, any broken bones, no scars, no defects. Our best, representing God's covering over our lives. And then the analogy that Jesus applies it, Jesus says, "This is my body," and teaching that Jesus was sinless, and the whole New Testament teaching on that. And the alcoholic wine would not fit that symbolism. The same with the unleavened bread, leaven being a symbol of again, a process of fermenting, or Paul uses an analogy of leaven representing sin in a symbolic way. And so if the fermentating process is a representation of sin, well, it wouldn't match. It wouldn't meet either the Passover symbolism or the New Testament symbolism that Jesus was making with those glasses of wine or grape juice. And so I believe that he used grape juice at his Last Supper, at his Passover. I believe it was grape juice. I believe that's what was originally used in the original Exodus. I don't believe in the original Exodus they drank four glasses of wine and then went, you know, charging out into the wilderness and crossing the Red Sea, you know, trying to escape the Egyptians.
Well, so because of misinterpretation, then basically in what, and that word, what is the word again?
Yayin.
Spelled?
Well, it's spelled in Hebrew.
Oh.
So in English transliteration, let's see, what would that be? I guess a Y-A-N-I-N could be a version. Because, again, the Hebrew letters are different than the English letters. So
yeah.
Transliterating it, but that's how it
close enough.
Be.
So the interpretation of yayin is basically became fermented, but you believe that it, because of the unleavened bread and the purity of it, it was grape juice. So wine and kosher wine on Passover came to be the traditional drink, although it probably really shouldn't be.
Right. Right. Yeah, and actually, in strict Orthodox circles, in Judaism, they won't even eat. You mentioned earlier the rice or other products that have any grains cooked in them, because they might ferment. That's their reasoning. These are products that might ferment. But then why do you have alcoholic grape juice and even matzah, which has grains in it? But they're trying the idea of, yes, the purity and the symbolism of not having anything that would ferment. And so why not then apply that also then to the grape juice that they're drinking? That would be the logical step to take, but they don't. But yeah, it's the same reasoning. The same reasoning is that the symbolism is to be the natural, the pure, the natural state, the pure state, the sinless state, the unblemished state of the object to fulfill the symbolism.
So kosher wine, basically then, is just pure wine that has not been touched by anything under, well, I was going to say not original biblical law, but a combination of both biblical and rabbinic law.
Yeah, I guess you could say that. In their certifying process, yeah. But once it's going through the fermenting process, it's going through its own decaying process.
Right.
So even though it was maybe, you know, made in as pure fashion as possible, it's still allowed to go through an aging, dying process. And again, the symbolism of both the blood over the doorpost and the symbolism that Jesus then applied to it, his Hebrew name would be Yeshua. So when he was doing the Passover, the disciples called him Yeshua. They didn't refer to him by our English version of that, but he also was representing or saying this is representing life, not representing death. His death was supposed to represent life for his followers. And so the symbolism would not be one of fermenting, dying, going through a decaying process, but one that is, again, the fresh fruit of the vine, fresh and life-giving.
Uh-huh. So kosher wine, then, is a contradiction upon itself.
Yeah, I guess. I just can't look at it that way.
Wow. Interesting.
I don't know if on even, you know, your previous shows that you've been talking about wine and things, that you've ever gotten to the discussions of some of the studies that have shown, you know, wine, countries that have a tradition of drinking a wine, a glass of wine with dinner or something like that, have less heart problems and things like that. Have you ever?
We've discussed that before, and it's, you know, especially France, the French
right.
paradox is the most famous country for that, and you know it's fascinating, and it's not just grape juice so much as the fermented grape that gives the benefits, and more so than just grape juice and stuff. So,
okay, because I've read the studies or some articles by doctors that I know that have said no, it's just that it's the grape. It's
yeah.
whether in the fermented form or non-fermented form, but the properties were in the grape. So maybe there's some studies indicating what you just said too. But that's
they're saying that a little bit of alcohol every day, and I've read these articles. A little bit of alcohol every day is good for you. I mean, a shot of whiskey, a shot of vodka, a shot of whatever. They're saying that for some reason helps the body. And so the antioxidants and the resveratrol and all this that is in the grape skin being fermented gives that little bit of alcohol in there. So it increases the benefits that much by going and having it as wine as opposed to just a glass of grape juice. So, yeah, it's... We found that it is, you know, we've talked about this before on the programs, that, you know, it is good for you. It is something that's good for you. And it's something that, you know, people are discovering more and more and more and more doctors are recommending and everything now because of the health benefits of it. So, well, Rabbi Jeff, thank you very much.
Sure.
We appreciate you taking the time out this evening to talk with us and explain to us a little bit of what a little bit of the background of kosher and what kosher is and what it means and why it is so popular during Passover time. Then, so
right,
it's
right, yeah, it's all, a central part of the Seder.
Yeah, and that means Seder means congregation or
oh, Seder means order. So the
order
Seder. Literally means the order of the Passover, the order of the, because there's a set, like I said, there's the four glasses that we drink of the wine or the grape juice, and that we do it, it's a set place where those are done. So there's a specific order. And again, as we do it today, and as people read the gospel historical account, they match up. Even
yeah.
though 2,000 years difference in time, and going back to the original Passover, 3,500 years difference in time, the order is still pretty much intact.
Fantastic.
Pretty amazing.
And that's why it works.
Yeah, yeah. Ron, I appreciate you having me on, too. If I could invite your listeners, if they want to come to see a Passover Seder, they're welcome to come to the one we'll be hosting in the Newport Ritchie area on March 25th, on Monday night, March 25th, at 7 o'clock at the Beth El Shalom Synagogue in Newport Ritchie. We also have one in St. Petersburg. I don't know how far your viewing audience is, but we'll be hosting one on Tuesday night in St. Petersburg. And they can see more information at our website, which is www.jewishheritage.net. And so they're welcome to come to that and see that. If they can't come out to this area, don't live in this area, we have a way that they can do one at home. We've got a video, again, on that same website, and they can click on the link, Shalom Adventure, and it'll take them where they can watch a whole Passover Seder, and they can follow along right there in their own homes.
Sounds fascinating. It really does. We'll check our schedule, and we may try to make it down to that. That sounds like
be great. Glad to have you.
Very interesting. So, again, thank you for taking the time out this evening and explaining to us some of that stuff. And, I may be seeing you in a week or so.
Great. Thanks, Ron. God bless you.
Thank
God bless
you.
Your listeners. Yep.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yep, thank you.
I forgot to ask you any questions, Mike. I'm sorry.
No, I was taking my notes as usual, and everything's good. I'm looking at their website now. Very interesting.
Yeah, I just things I didn't know. Obviously, not being Jewish, these are things we don't know.
Yeah.
So
yep. I'm still cutting. Are you still cutting out? I can't tell. Okay. Well,
so that pretty much takes care of kosher and Israeli wines this week. And so if, as always, if anyone has any comments, questions, or anything, by all means, get in touch with us through the website or Facebook or any, call us or anything, and we'll be happy to address your questions or comments.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you have anything going on at the I don't think there's anything on your schedule for the winery this weekend, is there?
Not this week. No, we have a quiet week coming up here, which is unusual, really. we have a quiet week. So no, nothing going on this week. We don't have classes, we don't have a festival, we don't have a rattlesnake festival down the street. We don't have a kumquat festival down the street. We don't have state fairs going on. We don't have strawberry festivals. I mean, it's just a quiet week here in Florida in this area.
Yep. Finally.
we got Sunday is St. Patty's Day, St. Patrick's Day. And we do have our key lime wine. So if someone wants a green wine for St. Patrick's Day, we have green wine, our key lime wine.
And it's very good. You definitely have to try that out. Get over to the winery. You are open. So are you going to be open? I guess you're going to be open Sunday, right?
Yeah, we'll be
open. Considered a... say the kind of,
Well, I bottled okay. The Plantation White and Plantation Blush yesterday. Put in a 12-hour day and got both those bottles. And today is the first day I've had off in like 3 weeks. And so... then I go back and start all over again. We have a group coming in tomorrow. We have an event tomorrow night that I got to go to and all that. So it's it starts all over again. So, I can't complain. It's good. It's business, but it gets you wore out. And then we need it to warm up or stay cold or do something. But this bouncing around drives me crazy.
Oh, I know. That's the worst thing. I mean, it's going to be back in the 80s again this weekend. So
yeah,
it's one of those things. And then I was talking to somebody while I was in Europe, in London, and they said there was snow on the ground. It was 30 degrees and miserable. And I'm saying, yeah, well, they're spring break over here. People are at the beach enjoying the sun. and then you wake up and it's, 40-something degrees again. So that was short-lived. But they're still out there. But that's the way it goes here in Florida. You never know.
You never know. That's the way it goes.
Yep, just like So, all right. I guess, did you have any other ads at the end? Anything to talk
about?
Yeah,
just, you know, give a little plug to your radio program. Mike's on there again with radio program. Listen to him last night, was it? Yeah.
I'm on Mondays and Tuesdays.
Night before last. Yeah, night before last, I tuned in, listened to Mike, and
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. I requested Red Wine, and Mike played Red Wine by U2 for me, which was cool.
That's pretty cool. So, yeah, so I'm back on. That was awesome.
So if you all get a chance, you can pick him up anywhere in the world. So give a plug to yourself on that.
Well, thank you. Yeah. We don't have to go any further with that, but yeah, that's fine. but I just Mondays and Tuesdays right now. And they're asking me to go on for more days, but that's a whole different thing. I was like, no, I'm not going to turn this into a full-time thing. But, they're interested in that. But that's the way it goes.
It was nice. You got listeners from all over on that, too. That's good to hear.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, the guy called from England, and that's always cool to listen to them or to talk to them because, of course, it's almost midnight there when they call and tuning in.
Unlike Australia, where it's in the morning, it's
yes, yeah, and it's Australia the next day, isn't it?
Right.
Yes, so they won't get my show until Tuesday or Wednesday.
Wednesday,
I don't know how that works. I forgot about that. If you're tuning in on Australia, it's Tuesday or Wednesday. So, thank you for that. I will. I guess we'll go ahead and close the show. And next week, I
need to get a hold of them. I've had some people come into the winery 3 or 4 weeks ago who said they'd be willing to come on the show. They're growers, and they're in Pennsylvania, and they're growers, and they're looking at possibly opening up a winery and all that. But I asked them if they'd like to be on the show, and they said sure they would. So I'm going to get a hold of them, and we'll hopefully have guests. Just everybody out there, check out the Facebook or the Mike tweets to you once he finds out, and I'll let him know once I find out. So you can always check out and see what's coming up, but be sure to tune in regardless, because we always have a fun and interesting program.
That's right. Always have something on. That's cool. And it's been going like that for a while. And we're glad everybody's been able to join us and enjoy the show. It's entertaining and informative. And you learn quite a bit through this. And I should get a degree. What am I in my third year? Oh, I have one more year and then I get my degree. So.
You did? Yeah.
Well, if this was a college program,
this
was
a college program,
year,
we'd almost be there. Yeah.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Finally, I got my education. Okay.
I never thought of that. But that's,
Well, see?
And it's a lot cheaper, too.
It sure is. That's right. I don't know if it doesn't count. But anyway, it's great to have everybody out there tuning in worldwide. The numbers are picking up, and it's great to see that our live listeners and our extended family that listens on the archives are listening. And I appreciate that. And thank you for joining us again. And we'll see you all next week right here on All About Wine, possibly talking to a couple of Pennsylvania growers who might be starting a winery up there, which would be cool.
Yeah.
We may be back in Pennsylvania next week. So tune in. And if you go to the website, I have the Facebook feed on there. So you can just look at the first page. It'll show you the feed, and you'll be able to see what's being posted on Facebook. And you don't have to log into Facebook or anything or go to the page there unless you want to. But it's on the homepage. So go to the homepage at allaboutwinesbtr.com. And you get all the information, all the guest information, and everything. And I'm going to add our tonight's guest, because they do have a website, JewishHeritage.net. I will add that to the website tonight in just a little bit.
You want to find out about Passover. If you're not Jewish and you want to find out about Passover, check out that website. Like he was saying, give you some information there.
Absolutely. So
knowledge is good, regardless of what it is. Knowledge is good. So.
That's right. So we will see everybody back here at 7 p.m. Eastern Time next Thursday. Thank you for joining us, and y'all have a great week and a great weekend. And try not to shovel too much snow. as we we enjoy the outdoors here still.
Yeah.
And y'all take it easy. And we'll see you next time. Thanks a lot. Oh,
thank
here comes
y'all
the
very
ending.
Much.
Here comes the ending. Oh, boy.
Oh. Everyone.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio. A special thanks to our special guests who have appeared on the show. And thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in and supporting All About Wine. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and like our Facebook page. Go to twitter.com or facebook.com/AllAboutWineBTR. We welcome your comments and questions by email at allaboutwine101@gmail.com. The email address again is allaboutwine101@gmail.com. All About Wine is a weekly program featuring Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery. The winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. From Interstate 75, take exit 285 and go west for approximately 4 miles. Or from US 19, the Suncoast Parkway, and US 41, go east on State Road 52. The winery is open daily, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. for retail sales and wine tasting. Visit the gift shop and enjoy the peaceful setting outside under a large shady canopy of oak trees. Florida Estates Winery is pet friendly and picnics are welcome. For more information, call area code 813-996-2113. That's area code 813-996-2113. Or visit us on the web at www.floridaestateswines.com. Again, that's FloridaEstatesWines.com. Be sure to subscribe to our informative bi-weekly newsletter. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio.